Chapter 8, The Troubled King of Toys. In 1960, the Saturday Evening Post dubbed Marvin Glass the Troubled King of Toys. He was, without question, the reigning genius in an immensely lucrative industry that he helped create. At that time, the toy industry raked in almost $2 billion a year. It was a savagely competitive jungle where only the fittest survived. The most knowledgeable combatants on this creative battlefield agreed on one thing. Marvin Glass, a 45-year-old Chicagoan who measured 5 feet 5 inches, weighed 127 pounds, and slumped through life with the pained expression of a depressed dachshund, was the most important and prolific independent designer and idea man in the field. It was midwinter when I received my first call from Mr. Glass. I'd heard the name before, but, as in the case with many potential new clients, I knew nothing of his business. Within a few hours, I was anxiously plowing through 4 inches of snow on my way to learn, among other things, that the Glass office and his apartment were located in a sleazy downtown hotel at the corner of Ohio and Rush Streets. Before gaining entry to the office, I was carefully scrutinized through a small peephole in a steel door. Once inside, I was ushered through 3 more doors, each of which was locked. I felt like I was entering Fort Knox. I remember Mr. Glass being courteous but subdued at that first meeting. We sat for hours, discussing the toy industry and his role in it. It was quickly obvious his lack of national recognition outside his field bothered him. He was almost sad in describing his feelings and wondered if I could help change this apparent lack of respect. Though I was at least 15 years his junior, we talked philosophically that day about his life and goals. I had been told Glass was brilliant, but was also very dogmatic and at times could even be a tyrant. I quickly came to the conclusion we would have difficulty working together because he was used to an entire staff of yes men. I felt I was the antithesis of that. I told him so, and that was the first time I saw him smile. He said being told that he was wrong might be a welcome change. Without either of us realizing it, we left that meeting and began what would be an 18-year business relationship. But this wasn't a typical business relationship. After all, this was the king of toys. In fact, Marvin must have fired me 15 times. I resigned the account at least that many times. From beginning to end, it was a wild roller coaster ride. Though we often disagreed, nothing ever weakened the deep respect we held for each other. I believe Marvin was the best read and most intelligent person with whom I ever had the privilege of working. He may have also been the most tortured. To Marvin, who read Plato and Aristotle and worshipped Beethoven, the daily reminder that he was not advancing anything but his bank account was reason enough for him to spend many of his waking hours hating himself. He never slept more than 4 or 5 hours a night. And he once told me he dreaded sleeping longer because it's like being dead. He constantly berated himself and was forever frustrated that he never wrote a book or a play or relieved anyone's suffering for an hour. Marvin was deep into psychotherapy and felt that many of his problems stemmed from his early years. I knew he was born in Evanston, Illinois, in 1914. His parents came from Germany, and Marvin told me their marriage was, at best, rocky. His father, an engineer, was a tall man who never could understand why Marvin turned out to be so puny. As a kid, Marvin was a dreamer, and his dreams seemed to manifest themselves in toys. For as far back as he could remember, he was inventing unusual toys made from whatever he could find. Public school for him was a disaster, and the private military academy his parents eventually sent him to was even worse. He was a loner who remained somewhat withdrawn from society, so he could spend more time creating. As an adult, there never seemed to be any middle ground. He was either in the pit of despair or at the peak of the mountain. I sometimes felt he actually enjoyed suffering. He smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, plus at least a dozen long, black, and expensive cigars. He was definitely a hypochondriac, believing every headache was a symptom of a brain tumor. He never understood the concept of a vacation, but on rare occasions made it to Las Vegas for a weekend. Marvin received his undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago in 1935, and by the time I met him, he had already experienced plenty of ups and downs professionally. He made a fairly big splash with Tiny Town Theater, a product he developed in partnership with his friend Joe Noodleman. Tiny Town Theater was a projector in which kids could insert and illuminate comic strips. The two men sold the idea for $500, and the manufacturer eventually made $30,000. That was the first and last time Marvin sold an idea outright. From then on, he preferred a royalty arrangement. His next successful invention was a toy-lined plastic bar that hung on baby cribs. After that came Hinges, a set of animated cutout figures. With Hinges, Marvin was able to build franchise agreements with the creators of Mickey Mouse, Blondie, and several other famous cartoon characters. He took his share of the $94,000 profit, bought out his partners, and set himself up under the firm name Marvin Glass & Associates. Within the toy industry, he was quickly developing a reputation of a prodigy. Marvin's stock continued to rise with the introduction of his Catholic weather chapel. This little chapel contained a moisture gauge that caused a Sacred Heart to appear as a sign of good weather to come. To ward off adverse conditions, St. Barbara, protectress against disasters of nature, materialized. The chapel netted Marvin enough profit to record his first million. On the downside, Marvin turned around and invested most of his limited fortune in an idea that involved stained glass picture windows. To support its sales, he bought and launched a nationwide advertising barrage that began one Sunday before Christmas. Within a week, the scope of the disaster was plain. In debt up to his ears, Marvin borrowed from friends to start fresh. With another toy designer, Eddie Goldfarb, he created the Bussy Bitty Chicken. When pressed, the chicken unburdened itself of 5 marbles, one at a time. These peculiar poultry retailed for 39 cents, and Marvin's company netted over $300,000. Goldfarb went to work for Marvin, and together they created the Yakety Yak Teeth, a motorized set of dentures. When wound, the motor made the teeth click. They sold the product's license to H. Fishlove & Company, which sold more than 3 million sets of teeth at $1 retail. The glass company's take was $84,000. While these creations were widely popular, it was the Tick Toy Clock that brought a real sense of pride to Marvin. Designed in 1959, it was a large open-faced timepiece with multicolored plastic parts that could be dismantled and put back together again. The toy needed to be rewound every 12 hours, but kept reasonably good time. Marvin's ingenuity with the Tick Toy Clock helped lure millions of children into the act of self-education, while spontaneously satisfying a common childhood desire to take a clock apart and rebuild it just to see what makes it tick. Long before Christmas of that year, more than $2 million worth of the clocks had been sold. Marvin must have told me 100 times, a toy is the only thing measured down to a kid's size. A toy helps a child cope with reality. National awareness brings increased respect. Among Marvin's senior partners, no one could understand Marvin's motivation in developing a public relations program for his company. It seemed fairly obvious to me. If Marvin wanted an audience to demonstrate his latest toy product, he was forced to go to the manufacturers rather than having them come to him. And, despite Marvin's proven credibility, none of these companies were willing to place the glass name and logo on their boxes. Marvin's top men apparently felt additional recognition, awareness, and respect were not key elements in increasing their business. They were wrong. Within 1 year of beginning the PR program, there was a tremendous change in attitude on the part of all glass customers, and a sudden growth in the sales of glass products. There were several solid reasons behind the company's surge in prestige. First, toys were hot, and the industry's rise in volume brought plenty of media attention. Second, with a new emphasis on the use of plastics, toys had increased in size, and with this increase came a larger package and a higher price. Third, Marvin, with a little help from his PR agency, had established his company as the unquestioned leader in independent toy design. Lastly, Marvin proved to be an outstanding interview. His fearlessness and unabashed honesty with the media made him readily quotable, whether responding to questions relating to toy safety or discussing toys as an educational medium. He always said, "There's no such thing as a safe toy. A simple rubber ball in the wrong place is a threat to safety." Marvin also spoke against the grain on the procedure of testing products in order to discover what goes into a good one. You cannot write a great novel, paint a great painting, or compose a great symphony with product testing. Neither can you create a great toy that way. Marvin always felt tests were unfair. "Too much depends on who's doing the testing, what questions are asked, and what the kids in the test are like," he'd say. "A child doesn't know what he wants anyway. Believe me when I say that what appeals to me appeals to a child." To understand the mercurial world where Marvin flowered and launched one popular product after another, it's necessary to examine the forces of the day. To begin with, the stakes were high and getting higher. From 1960 to 1965, toy sales increased more than 60%. At that time, there were more than 2,500 American firms that were considered toy manufacturers. However, the mortality rate among these companies even then was steep. Today, with all the mergers and acquisitions that have occurred, the total number of manufacturers is nowhere near that number. Only a few hundred hang on more or less permanently, and many of these are overextended and underfinanced. It's a fashion business nearly void of reliable statistics. Attempting to determine public tastes in toys is equally elusive, because toy purchasers and users are rarely identical. Marvin liked to say a parent buys a toy because it's what they'd want to play with, but any effort to read this mood and capitalize by getting ahead of the market is like stepping into the unknown. Marvin often likened this to producing a Broadway show. Anything goes. In one interview, Marvin said, "Kids are ultra-conservative. They're too insecure to be innovators. Instead, they're imitators. If it's to work as a toy, it must be something that the child has seen before and can understand and manipulate." The change in size from toys like Bussy Bitty Chicken and Yakety Yak Teeth helped spur some of Marvin's most successful creations. Along came bigger toys like Mr. Machine, Robot Commando, King Zor, Kissy Doll, Odd Og, Bop the Beetle, Golferino, Mr. Mixer, Penny the Poodle, Dandy the Lion, Jungle Hunt, and Razzmatazz Piano. It was an era that brought great attention to the glass company, with major feature story placements in prominent national publications like Time, Newsweek, Business Week, Fortune, the Saturday Evening Post, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. The Journal story, a front-page, right-hand column placement, was truly unusual, because Marvin Glass & Associates was not a public company. His hometown paper, the Chicago Tribune, published the Glass story with a full color cover on its Sunday magazine section. All this national exposure was for a company that had previously only been covered by the national toy trade magazines. Marvin was on a great high and very much in the manic stage. He could feel the attitudinal change in his clients. They were thrilled and honored by the prospect of being invited to the glass offices to view a particular toy in progress. The question most often asked by the media was, where did this idea come from? Talking about his first really big hit, Mr. Machine, Marvin likened it to modern man. It's transparent, screams, and makes a lot of motion without doing anything, he'd say. The idea for Mr. Machine actually came from the often fortuitous combination of accident and inspiration. Marvin was talking on the phone to one of his ex-wives, and she was being particularly belligerent. She told him the reason for their marital breakup was that he was nothing but a machine. Marvin told me that when he hung up the phone with her, he went directly to the studio. It was 4 a.m., and he created his first mock-up of Mr. Machine, which he always considered an autobiographical toy. He was addicted to work and expected everyone on his staff to share that same philosophy. Staffers would work 80 to 90 hours a week and were used to Marvin calling a project meeting whenever he got an idea, which was frequently in the middle of the night. It was such a meeting that the idea for Robot Commando was born. Marvin had just finished reading George Orwell's novel, 1984, when he had a vision of a friendly big brother, an inconceivable machine that would move at a child's command and protect him. After much debate and swapping of ideas, the project was codenamed C-42A. C was for Commando, 42 was its project number, and A represented its position as a top priority. For two feverish weeks, the staff labored night and day. It wasn't easy to figure out how to cram the necessary motors and working parts into the toy's plastic shell. The shell was repeatedly altered to provide for new gears and electrical connections. The final model had two motors, one for movement, the other for the cannon arms and a missile-firing head. The toy's flashing eyes looked sinister in semi-darkness, but not in daylight. And they were a drain on the batteries. It was just too complicated. Drawing an analogy to automobile manufacturers, each year brings a new innovation, and each innovation costs the consumer hundreds of dollars added to the base price of the new car. In toy design, Marvin liked to point out that each major innovation needs to be added at a cost of perhaps 10 cents. Not an easy chore. Designing the project took a full year and had involved solutions of 6,400 separate mechanical and engineering problems. When Marvin accepted the final model, he called it Robot Commando and made his telephone call to the president of Ideal Toy Company in New York. The previous year, Marvin had sold Ideal Toys on that autobiographical robot, Mr. Machine. It was all the rage that Christmas, grossing more than $7 million in retail sales. It was so popular that Ideal couldn't make it fast enough to satisfy demand. Now Marvin Glass had another idea, and Lionel Weintraub, Ideal's president and CEO, was itching to see it. Once through the security envelope, Marvin greeted Weintraub at his office, offered his visitor a chair, and brought out another of his innovations in the toy industry, a confidential disclosure agreement. By signing it, Weintraub would guarantee that, if he did not buy the toy he was about to be shown, Ideal would not make another like it. Weintraub agreed. Marvin, the showman, opened a curtain, and standing at the center stage was a small device of futuristic automation, something out of Space Odyssey. Marvin scooped it up and put it on the floor. From the robot's back extended a long cord with a microphone attached. Marvin shouted into the microphone, "Robot Commando!" The thing stirred to life. It hummed and buzzed, and its eyes began to move, as if in a penetrating, searching gaze. I watched Weintraub stand transfixed as Marvin shouted commands into the microphone. The robot marched around the room, fired rockets, and hurled plastic grenades. Weintraub was sold, and as an ideal product, Robot Commando turned out to be the toy sensation of the year. With Marvin's continued dominance in the field, he was convinced more and more people were willing to buy their children one good toy rather than a lot of inexpensive ones. He no longer saw children as inarticulate about their wants. Instead, they, not their parents, were becoming the driving force behind any successful toy. When kids said, "Buy me that," they would get it. Despite this transformation in buying power, Marvin stood firm on his feelings about educational toys. "A toy is for fun," he'd say. "If it teaches a child something, so much the better." He believed kids needed a catharsis, so he made toys he hoped would make children laugh. He often said, "The best thing for a child to play with is another child, and the next best thing is a toy, especially one that can play back." Kissy Doll was one toy designed with this theory in mind. Marvin said, "Kids have been kissing dolls for thousands of years. It's about time the dolls reciprocated." King Zor wasn't quite as affectionate. This 3-foot-long toy dinosaur, inspired by Marvin's recollection of the legend of St. George and the dragon, looked terrifying. Zor carried 6 plastic prehistoric rocks on his back and a red bullseye on his tail. A child would fire a dart at the target, and a perfect strike would cause Zor to lunge towards St. George and launch one of his projectiles with a primordial roar. The designers figured Zor offered children, mainly boys, an outlet for their combative instincts and a chance to feel like a knight fighting an evil dragon. It was another runaway bestseller. Marvin did not believe in marketing a toy for a specific age range. As soon as a parent sees a toy labeled for 5 to 7-year-olds, for example, he or she tends to underestimate or overestimate the mentality of the child. With that type of attitude, Marvin made things easier on his staff. From a business standpoint, the real difficulty in toy design is to come up with a toy that's tough enough to withstand a child's play and simple enough to produce, but it's still sophisticated enough for children to find appealing. In working with Marvin, I saw firsthand that it could sometimes take up to 5 years to work out the kinks in a product. The epic of his Ricochet pistol, which retailed for what was, at the time, a sensationally high $3.98 and sold 1,003,000 units in its first 8 months, began 2 years prior to its appearance on toy shelves. At that time, operators who sold their toy weapons at 29 cents to $1.50 and rarely added a new wrinkle had long dominated the toy gun business. Late in 1957, a $3 gun that could be fired like a real pistol hit the market. Heavily advertised on television, it sold like crazy. For Glass, this was startling intelligence, and he and his colleagues debated the problem in one staff meeting after another. What could a gun be made to do? It could make a bang or even shoot bullets, but that was old stuff. Could it make a ricochet noise? Marvin, who spent hours each week scouting Western movies on television, thought the ricochet was the answer. After several failed attempts by staff engineers and electrical technicians, which spanned almost 2 years, they finally came up with a perfect sound. That sound was inspired by the popular TV show Gunsmoke. The staff was clever enough to tape record the ricochet of a gun heard on the show, then play it through an oscilloscope and observe its vibrations. Adding sizzle to the cell. When the gun was perfected, Marvin put a call into Jack Holden, director of new products for Hubley Manufacturing Company of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the company's oldest and biggest toy gun maker. Holden agreed to a meeting, at which he willingly signed Marvin's non-disclosure agreement, and had his first peek at the gun. He wanted to try it for himself, but Marvin refused. Holden was told he had to assemble Hubley's board chairman, president, and 6 other key officials before Marvin would let him demonstrate the gun and its sound. Holden brought the men to Marvin's office, where they sat silently at a conference table, while Marvin wielded his gun in the middle of the room. "Gentlemen," Marvin declared, "the ricochet." With that, he fired. The men around the table smiled. Marvin, with sweat pouring into his eyes, moved about the room, ducking behind chairs and firing away like a TV cowboy. Then his shouts of, "That's it! filled the room, Marvin gently placed the gun on the table. The Hobley Company quickly signed an agreement, advancing Marvin an initial $50,000 against a 10.9% royalty on each gun sold. When the finished product was demonstrated at the toy show before an assembly of retailers, this often cynical audience did something that nobody could recall their doing before. They applauded. A few years later, in the wake of President Kennedy's assassination, Marvin vowed he would never design a gun again. Clients need to show courage and speak out. With a myriad of diversified toy products being constantly developed by the Glass firm, plus the idiosyncrasies and verbal gifts of Mr. Glass, the Cushman firm had a field day maintaining a continuum of national and international media placements. Marvin and his newest toy designs were now in demand by media everywhere. Because of his outspoken position on toy safety and his negative outlook on toys as an educational vehicle, we were providing public relations counseling in addition to pre-sale publicity. In 1971, Marvin's designs accounted for about $175 million of the toy industry's $3.6 billion retail sales, or about 5%. Success brought the need for expansion, and the firm chose to construct a building that could house the company's more than 100 model makers, engineers, designers, and audio specialists. But this wasn't just any space. While still residing in the downtrodden Alexandria Hotel, a virtual citadel of business rose from the ground at the corner of LaSalle and Chicago Avenues. Practically windowless, the muscular stone structure was designed with high-level security in mind. After the company moved into its new headquarters, visitors were greeted at the menacing iron front gate by a closed-circuit television camera. Once inside the building's perpetually locked doors, they found security personnel maintaining a heavy presence. Getting into Marvin's personal office, which was lavishly furnished with original paintings and Tiffany glass, involved a series of clearances. The designer's work cubicles and the machine shop were considered off-limits to most visitors. Exceptional visitors, usually meeting a representative of a major national publication, would be taken on a hurried tour of the building, with white sheets covering next season's toys in progress. Even internal windows were covered over to prevent workmen who periodically remodeled the facility from spying. Marvin's ideas were worth millions, and he was determined to safeguard them. While Marvin was ferociously protective of his company's ideas and image, he didn't seem as concerned with how others might view his personal life. He was an eccentric, and there really was nothing common about his everyday existence. Although he had been divorced 4 times, twice from the same woman, Marvin always prided himself on his sexual prowess. Few would have mistaken him for handsome. Yet in all the years we worked together, he had that subtle knack for attracting the most beautiful women. Unquestionably, his gift of gab made him fascinating to women, particularly younger women. His unlimited generosity simply added to his appeal. We sat together on a flight to New York for another toy fair and were served by a generous blonde stewardess. Her name was Dixie, and she was truly stunning. Despite Marvin's uneasiness on planes, he was obviously attracted to Dixie. At one point, he leaned over and told me he was going to have dinner with her that night. I laughed out loud and told him to forget it. I said she's probably married or engaged, or at the very least, has a ton of men at her beck and call. Marvin took this as a challenge, and before I knew it, the two of them were holding hands. And she had agreed to dine with him that evening in New York. The man was smooth. For years between marriages, Marvin dated a Playboy centerfold. Doris and I spent many evenings out with Marvin, and this young woman, who, despite the stereotype, was extremely intelligent. However, the favorite topic of conversation was Marvin's insatiable sexual appetite and his amazing ability to satisfy any woman. According to Marvin, he was quite an accomplished lover. He said he owed his past marital troubles to the fact that he loved the chase. Once he had won over a woman, he'd tell me, and she had agreed to become his wife, it spelled the end of any sexual relationship between them. Marvin told me that once married, he could never share the same bed. Marvin's professional relationships were certainly more healthy and long-lasting than many of his personal relationships. Pauline was his secretary, administrative assistant, and an all-around anchor of support. She was an Oriental beauty with brains to match, and reminded me of the Dragon Lady from the popular cartoon, Terry and the Pirates. She was an unheralded confidant. Whenever and wherever there was a job to be done outside the shop, Marvin called on Pauline. She was with him for years, and definitely went beyond the call of duty, right down to the selection of his clothes. Pauline not only shopped for Marvin, she helped maintain his Evanston mansion. She made reservations for deluxe hotels, first-class flights, limousines, theaters, and restaurants. With the top brass of the toy industry regularly coming to see King Marvin, Pauline would step in and plan their evening's entertainment. She was always busy and always under the gun, but always kind, considerate, and soft-spoken. With Pauline's help, Marvin's extravagant home was now a true show palace. It was built to fit the manner of the elegant bachelor and studded with original paintings by Picasso, Chagall, Dali, and Rouault. It also boasted a sauna, large pool with liquor dispensers along the back wall, and two chefs. Marvin's personal favorite chef was Poi Tom, an outstanding practitioner of gourmet Chinese cuisine. Poi Tom was more than capable of preparing a first-class menu for large groups of guests to one of Marvin's many dinner parties. It was fairly common for Marvin to host many of the nation's top toy executives at his home. Pauline would routinely hostess these evenings and assure perfection. By midnight, she'd be on her way home while the men were invited to the lower level of Marvin's home for a swim in the pool. I attended a good many of these parties, which often led to my fiercest battles with Marvin. These were based on the fact that the executives down in the pool were soon joined by a bevy of Playboy bunnies. I simply did not want to participate at that level, and it drove Marvin crazy. I never claimed to be a prude, but Doris and I were newly married. He absolutely refused to believe in fidelity and could never understand or respect my reticence. It actually upset him deeply. By the next morning, however, all the harsh words were forgotten. Success breeds success. While a bit unusual at times, these casual evenings gave me great exposure, pun intended, to the leaders of major toy companies. Marvin was wonderful, enthusiastically recommending my company to other toy executives. They were familiar with the incredible coverage we had landed for Marvin. Ultimately, Aaron Cushman and Associates Incorporated represented toy clients that included Ideal Toy Company, Topper Toys, A.C. Gilbert Company, Fundamentions Whitman Publishing Company, Hubley, Hasbro, and Merry Manufacturing Company. At different times over the years, I've been shocked at the naivete of corporate executives with regard to the mystic area of public relations, their complete lack of realistic comprehension as to exactly what professional practitioners can accomplish on their behalf, is probably tied to their perception of those few public relations people who would sell an exaggerated emphasis on their own personal media contacts and their ability to guarantee placements. One such example of this is an experience we encountered with the Topper Toy Company. Understanding your client's expectations. Topper was the largest toy company in gross volume sales in the early 70s. As a small but growing agency, you can imagine our excitement when the president and CEO of Topper Toys invited the Cushman Agency to Elizabeth, New Jersey, to discuss our retention as their agency of record. Marvin briefed me on Topper's marketing direction and offered me a bit of information about the gentleman whom we were about to meet. The company was marketing large plastic toys in giant packages through supermarkets, at which time was a very unique approach. The CEO was a refugee from Nazi Germany and a brilliant engineer. I made the trip to Topper with Lee Block, a senior vice president of our firm. To our delight, the meeting went well. We left with a new account and the largest annual fee we had to date. We returned from New Jersey as conquering heroes. Our entire staff greeted us with wild applause and a good amount of backslapping. Over the next 3 months, Lee and I made the trip to Elizabeth several times to present our creative plan for approval. The leadership of Topper unanimously praised our plan. Before leaving this time, we asked for permission to announce the fact that our company had been retained. Lee drafted a simple 2-paragraph press release, and we forwarded it to Topper for approval. With approval obtained, we proceeded to release the story to all of the toy trade publications. By that time, we had built many solid relationships within the toy trades, and in particular, with one editor named Amos Amory. Amory phoned me as soon as the release hit his desk. "Aaron," he said, "I've been waiting for an opportunity to do a major story on your company, and this Topper announcement gives me the right vehicle." I immediately expressed my thanks and appreciation. Amory's story broke the very next week. In its lead, Topper Toys of Elizabeth, New Jersey, which last year had gross volume sales of $80 million and returned a dividend of X per share, today announced the selection of Aaron D. Cushman and Associates as their public relations agency. The story went on and on about Topper, and also extolled our virtues and experience within the industry. An hour later, a Topper executive was on the phone. I could tell he was upset from the tone of his voice. "Did you see the story?" he asked. "And was it a press release that you issued?" I told him, indeed, I had seen the story, and no, it was not the story we had issued. But I pointed out it certainly was positive. I couldn't understand what was troubling him, but before I could utter another word, he said, "You're fired." After a short pause, I asked why he was troubled by the story. "If you cannot control what the press prints," he said, "we don't want you." I tried to explain to him we're a factual information source, but once that information is in the hands of the media, it's their prerogative to print it or not, and to embellish it or not. We cannot, nor can any other PR organization, I continued, control what actually goes into the public domain. It was no use. I hung up the phone and sat at my desk, feeling absolutely desolate. In my frustration, I put my head in my hands and bent forward on the desk. Lee had sensed something was wrong and came into my office at that moment. He took one look at me and knew immediately what had happened. I confirmed it in a cracking voice, and Lee broke down crying. He told me he just couldn't take this type of irrational action by any client. He told me that was it. He was getting out of the business. A month later, Lee kept his word, and our company was a 2-time loser. Topper was gone, and so was Lee Block, one of my best men. Lee went back to the hospital medical field, where he started and made his mark within that burgeoning industry. To this day, I miss his solid professional counsel and his friendship. I'm not sure if the leaders at Topper learned anything from this experience, but it taught me to be very aware of what others might consider the role of public relations to be. I believe, in the long run, it helped me to better connect with clients to ensure that, while we were learning how their business works, they're being given a clear understanding of how our business works as well. Nothing replaces showmanship. Marvin was different, although he'd rant and rave about my uselessness every now and then. He really understood the score from the start. He capitalized on our resources, and we made the most of his talent. He also had a flair for the dramatic. He was a showman every step of the way, including those times when he was forced to bring his designs to the manufacturing companies. For effect, Marvin carried his toys to prospective buyers in a gorgeous mahogany box that he chained to his wrist. When he opened the box, it was like magic, and he only got better at it. He once created a black doll when they were almost unheard of. This wasn't a white doll painted black. It was designed after Marvin conducted a search for a black model. He emphasized accuracy. Feeling confident with a finished product, Marvin asked me to conduct a market study analyzing the potential market size for this doll. Once armed with statistics that indicated its potential, Marvin invited key leaders in the toy industry to view the doll. After those leaders signed the usual non-disclosure agreements, the room went dark. Then two small spotlights popped on to display the doll and the model on rotating pedestals, each dressed exactly the same. On other occasions, Marvin really threw himself into the sales pitch, getting down on the floor and playing with his creations. He was known to say, "Any man who doesn't enjoy playing with toys should get out of this business." The highlight of each year's planning and production was the trip to the New York Toy Fair, held each year at 200 Fifth Street, where almost all the major toy companies had their permanent showrooms. The toy fair brought together all the buyers of the national retail stores and chains, the major buyers from companies like Sears, Kmart, Toys R Us, and Walmart. We're always given the first opportunity to view new products and invited 1 week prior to the formal opening of the fair. The glass entourage planned to attend with the key buyers, and an entourage it was. Marvin sent Pauline ahead, usually with his Chinese cook, Po Tom, to prepare his suite and arrange all his clothes. In addition to most of his eight partners, Marvin liked to travel with his psychiatrist, his banker, his attorney, his public relations counsel, and his current amour. It was quite a group. By the morning of the first day, rumors of various product successes were already swirling in Marvin's suite. He always stayed at the Swank Regency Hotel on Park Avenue, where he was given true celebrity treatment. The phone in his suite was ringing by 7:30 a.m. On the other end was the president of one toy company or another telling Marvin the product he'd licensed to them was the talk of the show. By 10 a.m., having received at least 10 calls, each excitedly proclaiming their company had a runaway winner, Marvin was beside himself. He couldn't wait for the limousine to arrive and carry him and his entourage to the fair. Indeed, his arrival at the fair had the aura of the second coming. From showroom to showroom, Marvin was hailed as the Messiah of toys. The proverbial red carpet was rolled out for him. Each CEO proclaimed that his glass product was selling at a rate of so many millions, and their largest problem, their only problem, was keeping up with demand. It was no wonder that as we left the showroom for another, with the cheer still ringing in his ears, Marvin would stop in the corridor, lift up his arms and shout, "I am the greatest!" In this manic state, he would continue for several hours, proclaiming over and over, "Sieg Heil, I am the Führer." To the senior man in each company who relied on the glass company to fill their new product needs, Marvin was truly a savior and worth every dime paid to him in royalties. Many junior members of these manufacturing companies smirked behind Marvin's back and chuckled at the idiosyncrasies of the man and the size of his traveling ensemble. Between showroom visits, we managed to get him 2 to 3 interviews a day. Observers could begin to see the mental about-face taking place. Marvin was getting bored with the adulation and the repetitive backslapping. The depressive side of his personality began to appear. Nothing pleased him. Whatever Broadway show Pauline selected for the evening's entertainment wasn't good enough. The limo driver wasn't parked where he should be. The restaurant selection was terrible. The table, even worse. Traffic was miserable, and he definitely didn't approve of the television commercial being used by one or two of his clients. When entertaining buyers or being entertained by buyers, Marvin was able to disguise his true feelings. He'd save his outbursts for our return to the Regency. The first few days in New York were delightful. Now, everything was a nightmare. By the third night, most of Marvin's group had fled either to an early slumber or some other more pleasant activity. But for Marvin, this night was apparently reserved for attacking PR. He and I sat in the bar in the Regency, and he began his tirade by exclaiming, "Why do I need you? Look at all I've accomplished by myself. Besides, where was Time Magazine? I should be this week's cover story." He was unhappy with the interview he'd done with the Associated Press. "A waste of my time," he said. "Nobody reads their stuff anyway. And the local television show is a so what, who cares?" Even though I pointed out to him that the AP story meant a wire service placement that would appear in several hundred papers, and that the local television show interview just happened to be in prime time, when every buyer from every department store was locked in a New York hotel room. It was to no avail. He was dead set on railing against PR, his lack of interest in it, and its unimportance to him. When the attack got personal, I stood up, looked at him right in the eye, and said, "Marvin, you're full of shit, and I don't intend to sit here and let you vent your spleen on me. Good night." I turned and headed for the elevator. The morning after was always the same. At breakfast, he would stop by my table and quietly apologize for his attitude the night before. By morning, I too had cooled down and realized it was all part of being a manic depressive. As the years passed, I got better at seeing his tirades coming and learned to beg off early before things got hostile. But I also learned that, with Marvin, you couldn't always avoid trouble. If only Phil Donahue knew the trouble he avoided. For weeks, I had been making calls to major national and syndicated television talk shows that might be interested in booking Marvin as a guest. The producer of the Phil Donahue show was quite receptive to the idea. He was aware of the exposure Marvin had been receiving recently and thought we could work something out. At that time, the show originated out of Dayton, Ohio, but was syndicated on several stations throughout the Midwest. At one point in our discussions, Phil Donahue got on the phone and told me if I could deliver Marvin Glass with some of his toy products, he was prepared to devote his entire one-hour show to Marvin. I told him I would check the date with Marvin and get right back to him. Know your client's shortcomings. This was big, but Marvin hated to fly. Most of his interviews were either done in his Chicago office, at his home in Evanston, or by phone. Except for the New York Toy Fair, he rarely traveled anywhere, particularly if it meant flying. But I asked him anyway, hoping his ego would help him overcome his fear. Yes, he would do the show. I couldn't believe it. I asked if he understood that the show was done live from Dayton, and would require our traveling there with several product designs. Yes, he understood and was still willing to do it. I went on to explain to Marvin that because he was scheduled to do the entire show that day, Donahue would have no backup if we failed the show. Marvin assured me he would make the show and told me not to worry. With his assurance, I called Donahue and confirmed the appearance. In order to be on time, we had to make a 7 a.m. nonstop to Dayton. Knowing Marvin, I tried to cover every base in advance. First, I sent him a written memo that included a list of suggested items to take with us. Then I called Pauline to make sure he had it on his calendar. Then I personally called his driver and outlined the timing. To make the 7 a.m. flight, we would have to leave Marvin's home in Evanston no later than 6:30. I planned to arrive at his home at 6 a.m., rang the doorbell at 6 a.m. sharp, and that's when the nightmare began. No one answered the door. After three or four tries, I decided to knock on the back door. After more knocking, the back door began to open, slowly revealing the concerned face of Poi Tom. In one hand, which was raised over his head, Poi Tom held a large, menacing meat cleaver. Boy, it's me, Aaron, I practically whispered in fear. What do you want? What do you want? He kept demanding, while frantically rubbing sleep from his eyes. For what seemed like 10 minutes, we danced back and forth, me proclaiming that I had to get Mr. Glass up, and Poi telling me, Mr. Glass, boss man, him sleeping. Feeling the time burning away, I gathered enough bravado to push past Poi and his meat cleaver and make my way into the house. As I got to the bottom of the stairs, Marvin suddenly appeared at the top. He was still in his pajamas, looking like an unmade bed. Jesus, Marv, I said in disappointment. Today is the Donahue Show. Please don't tell me you forgot. We have 15 minutes to get the hell out of here and head for the airport. Marvin looked at me like he'd never heard of Phil Donahue. He proceeded to tell me he had a bad night, felt lousy, and couldn't possibly make it. I was furious, but held it in and focused on the mission of getting him out of there. I reiterated the whole situation, telling him we couldn't leave Donahue high and dry with no other guest as backup. For the sake of your own reputation, I implored him, let's get on the road. He eventually agreed to at least try to make the plane. I practically dressed and shaved him myself. Fortunately, the driver was on time and the limousine was already parked with the necessary toys. We piled into the car and I told the driver we had 18 minutes to get to O'Hare. I told him I was counting on him to go like hell, to fly if necessary. Forget about getting any tickets, I would take personal responsibility. He stepped on it. We shot up Dempster Street at about 75 miles an hour. But that only lasted about 2 miles. I looked up and could see we were crawling and there was no traffic in sight. I was sitting directly behind the driver and gave him a not-so-gentle nudge to get it moving. We were back to a cruising speed, but again began to slow a few minutes later. I started to lose it and screamed at the driver, "What the hell are you doing? Get this car in gear!" Again, our speed climbed dramatically before gradually slowing. I leaned over the front seat and saw Marvin pulling the driver's leg off the pedal. At 7:05 a.m., we pulled up in front of the terminal and Marvin smirked. "Gee, I'm sorry, but we missed the plane." "Like hell," I said, jumping out of the car. I began running down the terminal like a raving madman. As I reached the gate, I could see our plane pulling away from the terminal. I climbed all over the poor gate attendant. I begged, screamed, and cajoled for him to please bring that plane back. I made it sound like a life-or-death situation. If Mr. Glass didn't get on that plane, the world would come to an abrupt halt. Marvin and the others had arrived at the gate by then and were quiet and disbelieving bystanders to the unfolding drama. The gate person looked at me as though I was totally berserk, yet to my utter amazement, he proceeded to call the plane back. Remember that this was the early 70s. I doubt this would happen today. The craziest part of the story is that the airline had to kick 4 first-class passengers off the plane in order to accommodate our group. Glass was so impressed with the entire scene and with his feelings of omnipotence that he quietly got on board and never said another adverse word the entire trip. We made it to the studio on time, and the show came off without a glitch. Marvin was his usual charming and literate self, and Mr. Donahue never knew how close he came to having 60 minutes of empty airtime. About 6 months after the episode, Marvin called to tell me he had gotten Time magazine. He went on to say, "And I did it without you." I told him that was wonderful news, and then asked just how he had done it. Apparently, Time had contacted Marvin directly to express an interest in doing a story on him. "They knew all about me," Marvin explained. "They had seen much of the nationwide coverage I had received." I told him how pleased I was to know what a great PR man he had become. The funny part was that he really believed he had done it all on his own. In all the time we spent together, one of our most interesting adventures occurred when the British toy industry named Marvin Glass as the Brighton Toy Man of the Year. With the declaration came an invitation to attend the Brighton Toy Fair and to be honored at a black tie dinner. Marvin was overcome with emotion when he learned he was actually receiving international recognition for his accomplishments. Realizing the business potential this brought, let alone the personal ego boost, drove him to a level of excitement that I had never seen before. It was only after the initial enthusiasm wore off that he realized accepting this honor meant a transatlantic flight. It took him weeks to come to grips with this, and he ultimately decided to go. Now came the question of who would accompany him on this trip. Surprisingly, his first selection was his psychiatrist. Marvin viewed this as a life-threatening flight over the ocean. He was sure he'd need some help. He decided he'd need his PR man as well. This was certainly a major media story in need of professional handling. With another member of Marvin's staff along as well, we boarded British Air and settled into our first-class seats. Marvin had agonized over this trip for weeks. He was white-knuckling it from the start, but I became angry when the psychiatrist handed Marvin a gas mask not long after the takeoff. It would put him to sleep for the entire flight. I begged Marvin not to do it, but the doctor insisted. With Marvin incessantly mumbling in fits of terror, the 8-hour ride was horrible. Protect your client. Aside from my concern for Marvin's general health, I realized there was a good chance a strong media contingent would meet us at the airport in London. I didn't want the King of Toys coming down the ramp in a stupor. Unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. Marvin could hardly walk. I told the media it had been a difficult flight for him, but he would be fine in the morning. It took him almost 48 hours to recover. Luckily, by the evening of the dinner, he was 100% and raring to go. Riding in a Rolls-Royce, we drove from London to Brighton, where Marvin was feted at a gala reception for British toy VIPs and several high-ranking government officials. Then came the moment. It was a page right out of the coronation of a British king or queen. Royal-garbed ushers, replete in their red robes and white wigs, led us to the dining room. As the door to the dining room opened to reveal almost 1,000 guests, the royal spokesman stomped his golden staff and proclaimed, "Me lord and ladies, pray rise for the Right Honorable Mr. Marvin Glass." As one, the entire room jumped to its feet and applauded. Marvin was ceremoniously led down the aisle to his position at the head of the table. For just an instant, I looked at his face, and it was radiant. At that moment, all the wariness and worry surrounding the trip was forgotten, and all was well in his world. I was seated 5 or 6 places to Marvin's left, and I couldn't help but notice that no one was touching the food that had been placed in front of each position. A kindly woman on my right leaned over and whispered in my ear, "For heaven's sakes, please ask Marvin Glass to begin, or else no one else may eat." I scribbled a quick note and handed it to Marvin. He got the idea. Being the non-eater he was, everyone could have gone hungry were it not for that woman. In 1970, Marvin made the coup of his career when he enticed Anson Isaacson to join his firm as managing partner. Anson had formerly served as vice president of product development for Ideal Toys in New York, and was the man with whom Marvin and his staff worked closest on some of his most successful products. Anson had also been CEO of A.C. Gilbert Company, an old line and well-respected company whose claim to fame was the erector set and the chemistry set. Anson and I had a long-standing relationship. When he was named top man at A.C. Gilbert, he retained my company as public relations counsel. Anson was smart, knowledgeable, courageous, and very straightforward. There was no double talk. You knew exactly where you stood. Perhaps most importantly, He was respected within the industry and among all of Marvin's staff. Anson was calm and collected, an interesting change from the often frenetic Marvin. The marketing of a suicide. The marketing of a suicide is why some corporate executives responded to the news that Anson and Marvin had struck a deal with daredevil motorcyclist Evel Knievel. "We wanted to sell things that excite the imagination of the public," Anson said at the time, "and this does it." He was referring to the announcement that Knievel was preparing to jump the Snake River Canyon in Twin Falls, Idaho, in September of that year. From the commercial side, Knievel's great leap over the mile-wide canyon was shaping up as the hottest media event since the Billie Jean King-Bobby Riggs tennis match. The glass company had purchased the international rights to Knievel's name. At least 15 companies expected to cash in on the Knievel craze, and 9 had actually acquired rights to manufacture Knievel toys and accessories. These items ranged from watches, radios, and hobby kits to motorcycle-like accessories for bicycles and image printed on tank tops and other boys' clothing. Anson estimated that manufacturers of Knievel products would capture $200 million in gross revenue that year. Marvin Glass and Associates would collect 5-10% in royalties, and Knievel himself would receive about half of that. Several Evel Knievels took off quickly, especially Ideal Toys' Red, White, and Blue Sky Cycle, a miniature motorcycle modeled after the one Knievel intended to use in the jump. The 12-inch high battery-powered cycle with rider could jump a variety of hurdles and came equipped with trailer, toolbox, and accessories. The glass company received a $100,000 advance against royalties on this product in 1972. With a retail price of about $14, the cycle was expected to earn $18 to $25 million. Top Rank Productions Incorporated of New York had acquired the closed-circuit television rights worldwide for the Knievel jump and expected $11 million to come from broadcast rights with 2 million viewers in the U.S., Britain, Puerto Rico, and Latin America. They even spoke of a possible motion picture tie-in. Of Top Rank's total take, 60% would flow back to Glass and Knievel. The jump did indeed come off, although unsuccessfully. Knievel came away without serious injury. The media coverage was close to being overkill. While the daredevil was quite astounding, Evel Knievel the man left a lot to be desired. His personality often mirrored the image of his reckless jumps. There were months when he could be a courteous gentleman, but they were rare. In my experience, words like demanding, inconsiderate, and overbearing paint a more accurate picture. Nevertheless, thanks to the ingenuity and creativity of the Glass organization and the marketing savvy of Hanson Isaacson, everyone holding a Knievel license was enjoying expansive sales. I'd like to believe that we had something to do with the product's success. In the midst of the 1972 toy show, with the Ideal Toy Company display room jammed with dozens of buyers, I went into Lionel Weintraub's private office to extend my congratulations. Lionel was seated at his desk, his head in his hands, his eyes closed. He was mumbling quietly to himself. "Are you okay?" I asked. "I've got a $25 million headache," he responded. "I'm sitting here trying to figure out what to do next year to replace the $25 million in sales we'll achieve through the Knievel motorcycle this year. I know my board of directors and stockholders will soon be asking me that question, and I don't have an answer yet." This struck me as a peculiar way to react to success. I quickly realized it's just part of the ups and downs of the toy industry. It probably also serves as good reason why the CEO is paid so well. Marvin's successes have more than compensated for his failures. Two of his toys, Ideal's Mousetrap and Lewis Marx's Rock'em Sock'em Robots, have ranked among the industry's top 10 sellers for years. As the first three-dimensional game, Mousetrap changed the course of the children's game industry. Prior to Mousetrap, games had to have dice and spinners and something to push around a board. Mousetrap has a marble that goes through all kinds of gyrations, down steps, and through chutes, all just to push a plastic 3-ounce cage over a mouse. It's inspired several generations of games in the three-dimensional category. Marvin loved to tell the story of how Mousetrap came about. An acquaintance of his was in the exterminating business, and one day he described to Marvin the ways in which he caught rats. Marvin was fascinated, and a short time later picked up a book of Rube Goldberg's crazy, often three-dimensional inventions. Marvin simply put the two concepts together and went to work on Mousetrap. Marvin suffered through several months of serious illness before he died in January 1974. Throughout his illness, Anson kept the company rolling along. Upon Marvin's death, Anson was named president and CEO of Glass & Associates. Anson was particularly strong in arranging licensing agreements with Disney and major motion picture studios. He led the company through several years of growth and continued prosperity. On more than one occasion, he sent me to the West Coast to open negotiations for a licensing agreement. On one particular trip, I phoned Anson from Los Angeles the night before my return to offer him an update. He asked me to be brief because he was in a meeting. Then he suggested I come home early and fill him in on the details in person. I hopped the red eye that evening and called my son Gary, asking if he would please meet me at the airport. Gary was a recent college graduate and had joined our firm as an account executive. We planned to drive from the airport to our office, despite the fact that I was feeling tired after being up all night. My plane was about 30 minutes late, but after finding Gary and grabbing a cup of coffee, we headed for downtown. Traffic was uncharacteristically light that morning. We seemed to be off the expressway and in the loop in no time. We were riding up LaSalle Street and at Chicago Avenue past the Glass office building. At that moment, I had a sudden change of plan. "As long as we're right here," I told Gary, "it might be smart to stop and see Anson now." I thought we might catch him before his day got too busy. So Gary made a U-turn on LaSalle, and we pulled into the Glass parking lot. Everything seemed quite normal as Gary and I walked to the building's steel front gate and faced the closed-circuit television camera. We were buzzed in and started up the stairs to the receptionist desk, when all hell seemed to break loose. Pop, pop, pop. The sound of gunfire pierced the air. I was accustomed to hearing so many unusual sounds in this building that I let the thought pass. The screams that followed were not rehearsed. They were hysterical and all too real. I pushed Gary down and crouched next to him on the stairs. We laid there for what seemed like a few minutes. Suddenly, policemen with guns dashed past us on their way up the stairs. One officer bent low and whispered, "Are you hurt?" We shook our heads, "No," and he continued up the stairs. I vaguely remember telling Gary to get outside and wait for me. I slowly climbed the stairs. I can still hear people crying and screaming. When I reached the landing, blood was everywhere. Pauline came to me crying. Through her sobbing, she said, "Anson is dead." No one seemed sure what had happened, but it was obvious several people had been shot and most of those were dead. I stood there for just a moment, and then it hit me. Had I arrived 30 seconds sooner, my son and I would have been sitting with Anson in his office. A police officer asked me to leave, and I went back down those terrifying stairs to where Gary was waiting. By the time we reached our office, I had stopped shaking. We turned on the television news and the story was on the air. The details were still fuzzy, but by morning the newspapers had put the pieces together. Albert Keller, a troubled electronics specialist who had been in the Glass organization for 4 years, had stormed through the firm's executive offices on that fateful Tuesday, July 27, 1976. And shot and killed Anson Isaacson, 56, managing partner, Joseph Callan, 54, partner, and Kathy Dunn, 33, a designer. In addition, he wounded Donald Nix and Douglas Montague, then killed himself. It was ironic that the shooting took place in the building where security precautions had been considered fortress-like. With all the emphasis on protection from the outside, no one ever worried about any threats from the inside. The one story that I never wanted to write was Anson Isaacson's obituary. I had lost a good friend. On our way back from the funeral, Jeffrey Breslow, the company's newly appointed managing director, fired me. He told me he was sincerely afraid of any further exposure. He specifically mentioned his concern for his immediate family. I knew that almost after 18 years, it was over. It had been a magical time. I had watched the glass company gain worldwide recognition and respect to the point where companies like Parker Brothers, Bradley, and Ideal did incorporate their MGA logo in the phrase "designed by Marvin Glass Associates" on their boxes. Knowing that Cushman and Associates had played a key role in making that happen gave me a great sense of accomplishment. In succeeding years, I watched the toy trade publications carefully, and never do I recall seeing another story on the Glass organization. It's almost as though, from that day on, they ceased to exist.